You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Mike Cannon Show. This indie media radio program is produced for not-for-profit, community, and or micropower radio use worldwide. If you have any questions, comments, gripes, or suggestions, please feel free to email the show at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N, so that's all one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Up next, we'll be starting the second hour like we do each and every week with This Way Out, an LGBT and teen news magazine produced out of San Francisco. That'll take us past the half-hour mark. After that, we'll be bringing you some shorter pieces that could not fit into the first hour, including Women's E-News, Black Agenda Radio, Peak Oil Check-In, and a two-minute gardening segment, In Season with Lisa. That's the type of alternative non-corporate shows you've come to know and love. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to listen to the Mike Cannon Show. Normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6.
One of the fears is if members of the community are reaching out to law enforcement, or in addition to the domestic violence, are they also likely to be a victim of a hate crime?
It was originally billed as the Gay Olympics, but just days before it was scheduled to begin, the U.S. Olympic Committee filed an injunction that disallowed the word Olympics.
The film was made in 12 countries in 9 languages. I always say it took 6.5 years and a lifetime, really, because it's really about going into places of intense invisibility and trying to make that invisibility visible.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Panama purges its sodomy law, L.A. assesses services for LGBT violence victims, and queer Muslims wage a jihad for love. All that and a lot more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Steve Levin.
And I'm Mark Zega.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 16, 2008. Panama's president, Martin Torrijos Espino, has signed a decree repealing a 1949 law that punished consensual adult sodomy with a $500 fine or jail time. According to local media reports, the LGBT group New Men and Women of Panama and other human rights organizations had lobbied for the change. Also signed by Health Minister Rosario E. Turner, the decree said the law contravened the Panamanian Constitution and international human rights treaties that Panama has signed. It also conflicted with anti-discrimination policies of the Health Ministry's Sexually Transmitted Diseases Program. According to Amnesty International, 11 nations in Central America, South America, and the Caribbean continue to outlaw consensual adult same-gender sex. Antigua and Barbuda, Barbados, Belize, Dominica, Grenada, Guyana, Jamaica, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Trinidad and Tobago. All of those countries are former British colonies.
Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, has defended a new draft constitution for his country that grants same-gender couples the rights of marriage, according to a report in El Telegrafo newspaper. The document faces a popular vote on September 28th. Jesus of Nazareth never preached hatred, homophobia, or segregation, Correa said during his speech in Monteverde. What we are doing, he continued, is recognizing the dignity of all people without discrimination based on race, sex, or sexual orientation. A poll released earlier this month found that 47% of the electorate plans to vote for the new constitution, while 31% said they reject it. A yes vote of more than 50% is required for passage.
Not as many same-gender couples are taking advantage of the Czech Republic's registered partnership law than when it first came into force 2 years ago, according to a recent report in the newspaper Pravo. From July 1, 2006 to the end of that year, 235 same-gender couples tied the knot, but only 105 couples have done so in the first half of this year. The report also said that the largest number of same-gender partnerships have been contracted in Prague, Gay male couples have outnumbered lesbians, and there have been 9 same-gender couple divorces.
But the Australian Capital Territory's civil union law is being called a complete success, 3 months after it took effect. Even though only 23 same-gender couples have registered so far, it exceeds the 15 that the government had expected by this time, according to Territorial Attorney General Simon Corbell. He predicted with the onset of spring in Australia that even more couples would unite. The Civil Partnerships Act was passed by the ACT Legislative Assembly in May, after the territory agreed to a stipulation against formal ceremonies. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's Labor government said they would contravene a federal law limiting marriage to heterosexual couples. Territory officials maintained that the ceremonies were a matter of equality, but faced with an override, they removed the contentious clause. The Civil Partnerships Act gives same-gender couples most of the rights married couples enjoy under territorial law. A third of Australia's 8 states and territories have varying laws providing some benefits to same-gender couples.
The umbrella group behind a proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage in California, Proposition 8, has ended its fight over the wording that will appear on the November ballot. The so-called Protect Marriage Coalition said it made the decision this week after a state appeals court rejected their urgent appeal of a lower court ruling that upheld Attorney General Jerry Brown's revised title and summary of the measure. Further appeals wouldn't be heard in time to change the ballot wording before the November 4th vote. The measure was originally described as limiting marriage in California to a man and a woman. Brown changed the description to say that the proposed amendment would eliminate the right of same-gender couples to marry and that it could result in California losing tens of millions of dollars in tax revenues. Brown's office said that the original wording was written before the California Supreme Court struck down the state ban on same-gender marriage in May. Hundreds of lesbi-gay couples have since legally married there. Sacramento County Superior Court Judge Timothy Frawley had earlier ruled that, in light of the High Court decision, the revised wording accurately summarized the impact of the proposition. Both sides of the issue have agreed that the revised language will make the measure more difficult to pass. Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger opposes the amendment and has promised to campaign against it.
Meanwhile, several pro-LGBT bills in California are awaiting Schwarzenegger's signature. He's refused to sign any new legislation until lawmakers pass a state budget, over which Democrats and Republicans have been bickering well past the date mandated for its passage. While the governor's signature on any of the lesbi-gay-related measures is far from certain, the state's leading LGBT rights group, Equality California, has celebrated recent passage of bills to strengthen the state's sexual orientation inclusive civil rights laws to protect LGBT seniors and LGBT children in foster care, to provide tax relief for same-gender couples, and to establish May 22nd, his birthday, as a day to honor pioneering LGBT rights leader and assassinated San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. Right-wing opponents have reportedly been flooding Schwarzenegger's office with calls and emails specifically demanding that he veto that measure.
But Florida's Republican Governor Charlie Crist has announced his support for a proposed constitutional amendment on that state's November ballot that would ban any legal recognition of same-gender couples. The measure says, inasmuch as marriage is the legal union of only one man and one woman, no other legal union that is treated as marriage or the substantial equivalent thereof shall be valid or recognized. Florida law already limits marriage to heterosexual couples, but supporters of the amendment worry that it could be overturned in court. Opponents warn that the language of the amendment is so broad that it would also eliminate domestic partnerships where they're legal in the state. Those unions are also often favored by older opposite-gender couples because remarriage could jeopardize Social Security and other benefits. Activists in the state of Pennsylvania last month successfully fought efforts to place a constitutional amendment on the November ballot there to ban legal recognition of same-gender unions.
A U.S. federal appeals court this week rejected an attempt by opponents of Oregon's domestic partnership law to put a repeal initiative before that state's voters this November. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the determination of Secretary of State Bill Bradbury that a conservative group had failed to gather enough signatures to qualify the measure for the November ballot. Oregon's domestic partnership law allows same-gender couples and heterosexual couples unable to marry to form legally recognized unions, giving them hospital visitation rights and the right to make medical decisions for each other, to file joint state tax returns, and to have joint health insurance plans, and to take sick leave to care for their partner. It was passed by the legislature in 2007 after efforts to enact a marriage equality law were unsuccessful. Conservative groups immediately challenged the domestic partnership law in court, charging that it violated Oregon's constitutional ban on same-gender marriage. After those legal efforts failed, they began circulating petitions to place a repeal measure on the ballot. About 2,500 same-gender couples have registered as domestic partners in the state since the law took effect.
Elsewhere, LGBT people and their allies enjoyed Iceland's 10th annual Pride Festival in downtown Reykjavik on August 9th. Police estimated the crowd at 30 to 40,000. One of the organizers, Heimer Mar Pettersson, told local media that it was closer to a record 100,000 and that police can't count or they're counting wrong deliberately, but also commended their quick response to a bomb threat during the festival.
Inflammatory anti-lesbi-gay remarks by an Irish member of parliament probably inspired more people than expected to celebrate Pride in Belfast last week. An estimated 4,000 LGBT activists and their supporters marched in the parade despite bad weather. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown this week rejected calls for a formal censure of Irish MP Iris Robinson, who likened homosexuality to the sexual abuse of children during a parliamentary debate, and then, during a radio interview, called homosexuality disgusting, loathsome, nauseating, wicked, and vile. She also claimed that gays and lesbians could be cured and be heterosexual. In addition, serving in the British Parliament, Robinson is a member of the Northern Ireland Assembly. Brown's spokespeople responded to more than 15,000 calls and postings to the Prime Ministerial website demanding action against Robinson by saying that there's no constitutional authority for a prime minister to censure an MP, and that individual members are accountable to their electorate for their own comments.
And finally, police in Berlin have been asked to investigate an Arabic language magazine for incitement following its publication of an article titled "A Flesh-Eating Bacteria and Sexual Abnormality," warning readers not to shake hands with gays because they could transmit such diseases. One never knows what kind of bacteria and germs are found on them, it said. The article included comments by people the magazine said were authorities on skin diseases and was accompanied by graphic photographs of various skin infections. The LGBT Association of Berlin-Brandenburg filed a complaint with police this week against the free publication Al Salam, which is available in restaurants and cafes throughout the city. Incitement against minorities, including gays and lesbians, is illegal in Germany, but similar allegations have not been prosecuted in the past because some have warned that such actions would infringe on religious freedoms. LGBT activists are calling on leaders of the country's large Muslim community to condemn the article.
And that's News Wrap for the week ending August 16th, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Levin.
And I'm Mark Zecca.
A gay filmmaker searches for the homosexual heart of Islam, and queer athletes go for the gold at the heart of their dreams. Later in the program. With homophobic hate crimes on the rise in a number of major U.S. cities, sometimes it's hard for LGBT people to know where to expect the next attack to come from. It could come from law enforcement. It could even be at home. In Los Angeles, the city council created a new subcommittee this week to deal with how domestic violence is handled in the LGBT community. This Way Out correspondent Dan Fritz reports.
The LGBT community faces a high degree of violence from intolerance in Southern California. The LA County Human Relations Commission hate crime report for last year found that LGBT individuals experience proportionately more physically aggressive attacks, motivated by hate, than any other group. Transgendered people were most likely to experience a violent hate crime. 100% of hate crimes committed against them were violent in nature. Tara Slavin is the lead domestic violence attorney with the LA Gay and Lesbian Center. She advised the council in the creation of the subcommittee.
Issues of transphobia, clearly impact survivors of domestic violence. So one of the fears is if members of the community are reaching out to law enforcement, or in addition to the domestic violence, are they also likely to be a victim of a hate crime based on their gender identity?
Councilmember Richard Alarcón authored the motion to create the subcommittee to address the immediate needs for LGBT victims of domestic violence.
We're very short domestic violence beds. What are the policies that are used by shelters with regard to the LGBT community? Since there's only 800 beds, it's very difficult to get services for the LGBT community. So while this started with a conversation that I had with a human relations commissioner about disparate treatment between how police officers handle LGBT cases of domestic violence versus other cases of domestic violence, because they might fail to recognize it as a domestic violence issue, it has emerged into something that's far broader and hopefully will produce education, information, and new procedures to better handle the situations.
Slavin, the Gay and Lesbian Center attorney, says the agenda will include a focus on LAPD policy.
There's still a lot of invisibility and lack of awareness around the issue of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender domestic violence. And so one of the things that this committee is, you know, set up to do is both to sort of create a general awareness both within the LGBT community as well as within the mainstream community, and then look at the barriers to service. So whether it is, you know, in many cases law enforcement is still not acting or reacting in an appropriate manner, then there's, you know, kind of barriers across the border. Given the fact that the committee is a part of LA City and it sort of has an oversight over law enforcement, I hope we can really work with law enforcement around training and tracking and better serving the LGBT community.
Slavin expects initial reports from the new subcommittee to go public as early as January. I'm Dan Fritz.
Dreaming of a Gay Olympics, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. The concept of a gay Olympics is credited to a competitor in the 1968 Olympics named Dr. Tom Waddell. But in 1982, just 3 weeks before the first gay Olympics was to take place in San Francisco, the United States Olympic Committee obtained a restraining order forbidding the use of the word Olympics. Although the committee had not objected to the use of the word in events like the Nebraska Rat Olympics, the Crab Cooking Olympics, or even the Nude Olympics, Waddell lost his fight in a 1987 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. So, he named his event the Gay Games. Still one of the largest sporting events in the world, Waddell's mission continues to educate people through sport in the spirit of better understanding. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Hi, I'm Margaret Cho.
Hello, this is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm comedian Bob Smith.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
Hi, I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, I'm Scott Thompson.
Hi, I'm David Sedaris.
Hi, this is Jeff Straker.
Hi, this is Chastity Bono, and you're listening to
This Way Out.
This Way Out?
This Way Out.
The International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each program. All you have to do to receive one or both of these messages is email tworadio@aol.com. And be assured that we don't share or sell your email address or anything about you to anyone else, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com. That's tworadio@aol.com.
Homosexuality isn't a choice, of course, but many forget that often neither is religion. And that's certainly the case for the world's dense population of devout Muslims. Islam is now the second largest religion in the world. The documentary A Jihad for Love takes a close look at being gay or lesbian in often sexually repressive societies. This Way Out's Steve Pride talks with the film's courageous director.
Hi, my name is Parvez Sharma. I'm the director-producer of The Jihad for Love.
The Jihad for Love is the world's first documentary film on the coexistence of Islam and homosexuality.
I was very invested in trying to make a film that would have an important place in shifting the discourse about Islam away from a place of violence, away from everything that we see in the mainstream media. So in an interesting way, everyone in this film is really coming out as Muslim. Now, they do happen to be gay and lesbian, and their homosexuality is what brings them into deep and profound conflict with their faith. But for me, the film was really always about Islam and about everyone coming out as a Muslim.
How long did it take to make, and how many countries did you visit?
The film was made in 12 countries in 9 languages. I always say it took 6.5 years and a lifetime, really, because it's really about going into places of intense invisibility and trying to make that invisibility visible, but at the same time trying to do it with honesty and respect for the religion. Now, in the film, you travel to Iran, you travel to Egypt, you travel to Turkey, to Pakistan, to India. So it really covers a very wide expanse of the different worlds of Islam. And it does so in a way that seeks to present the real intense diversity of the religion and how it changes geographically and culturally and how the experience of being Muslim can differ substantially. What's really also amazing about the film is that it tells the story of the world's first openly gay imam, Mohsen Hendricks, who is a religious teacher in South Africa, and he's a father of 3 children.
How do the laws and attitudes differ from country to country?
We're in the year 1428 of the Islamic calendar now, and there was a sexual revolution inherent in the very birth of the religion. Now, many people don't automatically assume that, but when the Quran was revealed and subsequently after that, there was a tremendous amount of honesty in discussing matters pertaining to sexuality. What was also remarkable was that in the Muslim cultures that developed over time, like the Ottoman Empire, the Persian Empire, the Mughal Empire in India, homosexuality was not just tolerated, sometimes it was openly celebrated. Islamic art, literature from those periods is full of examples of, for example, older men and younger men, and the form of the young man is idolized in many ways. There's a lot of poetry about this. What happened, though, was that many sections of the Islamic world were colonized, and traditionally Victorian moralists or Orientalist scholars had looked at Islamic societies as dens of permissiveness where anything went sexually. But after colonization, a lot of penal codes were written into the codes of these countries that were brought in by the French or the British. Some of these penal codes still exist in countries like Lebanon, in Pakistan, in India, in Bangladesh. That's a huge chunk of Muslims on this planet. But after the colonizers left, and I'm trying to give you a wide sweep of history in a few sentences, really, people think that there was a rise in religious revival movements that were also freedom movements. So you had the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, for example. You had the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And the orthodoxy within the religion, really, in the 20th century, became extremely loud against homosexuality, inheriting some of the dogma from what they said was in Sharia law, but also from sort of Victorian ideas of morality, and in a strange way saying that homosexuality was a Western concept that had been imported into Muslim societies. So this, I think, complicates the film tremendously and complicates the premise of the film tremendously, in that there isn't just one way to look at Islam and homosexuality. And I think the film tries to stress that in the diversity of people you meet. So you meet a Sufi lesbian couple in Turkey who are living in a country that does not criminalize homosexuality. and who for the most part are living quite openly. But you also meet the imam in South Africa who is challenged substantially by a very traditionalist scholar of Islam who tells him that in a Muslim country, the debate would be not about whether to kill you, but how to kill you. Now, South Africa, though, interestingly, has one of the world's most open constitutions. And then in India, you meet a Shia cleric who tells a young man that the doors of forgiveness are always open in Islam. And when the young man persists with his questions, he says he should go and see a doctor. So there is a substantial difference, if you will, within the many worlds of Islam.
Many of the countries you visited wouldn't have welcomed a film crew making a documentary about gay Muslims. So how did you shoot it?
There was no film crew. A lot of times it was just me. But in a country like Turkey, of course, I filmed with an amazing Turkish woman who's also a filmmaker herself. When it was just me, it was usually about taking a lot of precautions, always traveling on a tourist visa, and adopting what many would say are guerrilla filmmaking tactics. So that would mean, for example, not using a tripod in public. That would mean trying to record innocuous footage for the first 10 minutes of the tape, for the last 10 or so minutes of the tape. This completely drove the editor crazy during the editing, but we had to do it. That would mean usually, always actually, putting the tapes in my check-in baggage as opposed to my carry-on baggage. And, you know, I remember one time in Egypt, I even made duplicates of the tapes and left them with a friend because I was worried they might be picked up later on. So there were many different precautions I certainly took. I had a few unpleasant encounters with law enforcement authorities, but usually, you know, the simple ancient art of bribery worked in getting me out of those situations.
This has been a conversation with Parvez Sharma, director and co-producer of A Jihad for Love. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Personal Best, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. The first gay games took place in San Francisco in the summer of 1982. The sports competition focused not on winning, but on achieving one's personal best. It was originally billed as the Gay Olympics, but just days before it was scheduled to begin, the U.S. Olympic Committee filed an injunction that disallowed the word Olympics. Their homophobic act created chaos and near collapse, as event organizers scrambled to delete the word from posters, programs, t-shirts, and buttons. In the end, however, the controversy energized the athletes as well as the spectators. Addressing an enthusiastic crowd of 12,000 at the opening ceremonies, author Rita Mae Brown said, "We're here today not to celebrate homosexuality, but to celebrate and affirm individual freedom." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
The 8th Quadrennial Gay Games will be held in July 2010 in Cologne, Germany. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Steve Levin, Mark Zecca, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Dan Fritz, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Dustin Richardson, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Musically, you heard Nadia from the MySpace Gay Newer website, that's N-U-R, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is primarily supported by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. please log on to thiswayout.org. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KEUL Girdwood and Hope, Alaska, 2ECR Eden, New South Wales, WHUS Storrs, Connecticut, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
Thank you. And now the winner of the Best Central Wisconsin Community Radio Station is voted by us computer voices, WNRB.
This is 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Heads up!
My friends, my opponent would rather lose a war than a campaign. He doesn't speak for our troops.
But Senator, Barack Obama has actually raised significantly more money donated by significantly more troops than you. With troops deployed overseas, it's by a margin of 6-1.
Oh, what do they know? The troops don't speak for our troops. I am the only one who can speak for our troops. Stupid troops, not donating to me.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of August 16, 2008. I'm Sandy Billings. Leading with good news, Cheers, the Democratic Party remains pro-choice. In a revised position statement last week, the Democratic Party retained strong support of abortion rights. The statement also puts a new emphasis on curbing unintended pregnancy through better access to affordable family planning services and comprehensive sex education programs. Cecile Richards, president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America in New York, said, quote, "The platform is unwavering in protecting a woman's right to choose. It is also a broad victory for women, recognizing that women's health care is not limited to a single issue," unquote. More news to cheer this week. The Center for Women in Government and Civil Society at the University of Albany in New York found that U.S. governors are appointing more women. The number jumped to 35% of governor-appointed posts last year. A major U.S. political party will consider a female presidential nominee for the first time since 1972. This will occur when supporters of Hillary Clinton nominate her at the Democratic National Convention later this month. Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women in Washington, D.C., said, quote, "Having her delegates tallied at the convention will ensure that this important step in history will never be forgotten," unquote. In 1972, the late Shirley Chisholm, a congresswoman from New York, was considered by the Democratic Party. 8 years before that, Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine was up for nomination at the Republican convention. Britain's Muslim Institute has released a new marital contract with the force of law that recognizes and protects a woman's equal rights in marriage. The contract is considered the most significant development in British recognition of Sharia or Islamic religious law. The contract guarantees a woman's right to divorce and to retain financial and property rights, and it eliminates the requirement that she have a guardian. An American Psychological Association panel found no credible link between mental health problems and abortion. Anti-choice groups have argued that abortions can cause depression and other mental illnesses. And a South Dakota state law that took effect in July requires doctors to inform women of such a link before providing the procedure. Psychologists analyzed hundreds of studies to prepare this newly released report. A National Women's History Museum might be considered by Congress. A bill that makes room for a National Women's History Museum near the National Mall was introduced last month and awaits action in the House and Senate. The National Women's History Museum currently exists only online. Religious authorities in Nepal have begun a new search for Kumari, widely revered as a living goddess and the incarnation of the deity Kali. The chosen girl may be as young as 3 when selected to spend her childhood in a temple. Critics have called the practice a violation of a girl's human rights. And a special report on women to cheer for at the Beijing Olympics. Katrina Emmons of the Czech Republic was awarded the first gold medal of the Beijing Olympics after breaking a record in the women's 10-meter air rifle event. Chen Zhijia won the women's 48-kilogram weightlifting, the first gold medal for host nation China. Erin Carroll of Australia lost a badminton match to become the first athlete eliminated from competition. She cheerfully told reporters that she would spend the next 2 weeks watching sport and eating what she liked now that she no longer has to stick to a training diet. Mali's first women's basketball team to compete in the Olympics held a brief, improbable first-quarter lead against the dominant U.S. women's team before losing 41-97. The Mali women asked to pose for photos with their U.S. opponents, who are idols to many players around the globe. The United States swept the women's saber event. Mariel Zagunas took gold, Sada Jacobson silver, and Becca Ward bronze. This is only the second Olympics in which women's saber has been included. Men's saber has been part of the modern Olympics since they began in 1896. Corey Cogill earned her first bronze medal in a women's trap match that included a suspenseful four-way shootout to determine the field's victors. Cogill learned how to shoot while hunting moose in her native Alaska. Kirsty Coventry, who has broken three world records and won three silvers in swimming at the Games, has resisted media pressure to condemn her native Zimbabwe's government. In a June interview with Australian television, however, she said something had to change in the country, where power-sharing talks between opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai and Zimbabwe's president Robert Mugabe have reached an impasse. On Thursday, various news agencies reported that Mugabe's government had confiscated his opponent's travel documents. And now for the downside of the news, jeers for news that jailed moms will lose their kids. Prison officials in Vancouver, Canada, reversed a four-year policy of allowing incarcerated women to care for their infants and children while in jail. Children will now be placed with relatives or into foster care. Safety was cited. Prison staff are not trained in infant care or first aid and are not prepared to handle emergencies. Social worker Allison Granger Brown resigned over the decision. She said, quote, "I perceive they were taking us away from rehabilitation and therapeutic programming and deeper into policy that was more about containment," unquote. More news to jeer this week. The Taliban claimed responsibility for killing three female Western workers with the Refugee Assistance Group International Rescue Committee and their driver in Afghanistan on August 13th. And in memoriam, the world's tallest woman, Sandy Allen, 53 years old, died in Shelbyville, Indiana on August 13th. Allen was 7 feet 7 1/4 inches tall and held the Guinness World Record for height since 1975. No exact cause of death was given. Allen had suffered from diabetes and blood, kidney, and breathing problems in recent years. These news briefs were compiled by Allison Stevens and Jennifer Thurston. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yin Radio. Background music is by Joan Hickey. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Sandy Billings.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing, so listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
The U.S. Justice Department is going through the preliminary motions of notifying six Blackwater mercenaries that they may be indicted in last September's massacre of 17 Iraqi civilians at a traffic circle in the heart of Baghdad. The proper punishment would be that meted out by the Angolans to four private assassins, including one American in 1976. Execution. But of course, Angola was exercising its right as a sovereign nation in dealing with hired killers, who are neither soldiers nor partisan fighters under international law, just criminals who murder for wages and the thrill of it. Iraq has no sovereign government, as proven by the fact that Blackwater's thugs are still breathing. Mercenaries are now an entrenched institutional factor in U.S. global and domestic security strategies. Barack Obama cannot even begin to explain how he'll disentangle U.S. mercenaries, euphemistically called contractors, from the uniformed occupation force in Iraq. The two forces are nearly equal in size, 144,000 troops and 126,000 highly paid civilians, 30,000 of them armed to the teeth. Washington considers the soldiers of fortune absolutely indispensable to the protection of key installations and personnel. On the home front, Katrina, that harbinger of what a future urban America in crisis will look like, saw hundreds of thugs from Blackwater and other mercenary outfits patrolling the streets of New Orleans as if they were the legitimate authorities. The day may not be far off when the New Orleans nightmare becomes a national reality. The specter of mercenary occupation of American cities is no longer far-fetched. It has already happened. The logic of permanent domestic mercenary deployment is rooted in the historical fact that the rich created the modern state to protect their wealth and to harness the nation as a whole to produce more wealth for their benefit. Mercenary armies and police forces put the lie to the pretense that the state serves to protect the general population. As the current corrupt order decays, the rulers find that due process and other niceties of law, including armies operating under codes of military justice and civil service police forces, restrict their freedom of movement. The process of dispensing with the traditional coercive organs of the state in favor of private mercenaries is well advanced in the United States, where the privatization of prisons of all kinds is in full swing. These are conscious, methodical decisions by the nation's corporate rulers rather than emergency measures. At some point, the privatization of coercive power becomes irreversible, as seems to have already occurred in the U.S. military. Despite the many crises caused by Blackwater's lawless behavior in Iraq, the U.S. State Department claims it can't get out of its contract with the outfit until next May, when, in reality, Washington has no idea how to replace its soldiers of fortune. If privatization of the military and police functions of the American state continues, there will come a time when no U.S. government will be capable of breaking a contract with their hired killers. There will be no one left but mercenaries to enforce the government's will. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
For Jason, the massive anti-war mobilization which crashed the 2004 Republican convention was a wasted opportunity to build a radical movement.
The people banked everything on the election itself. The election was the cause, but rather than continuing to organize in those networks, the reason for organizing disappeared.
4 years later, the issues are still there, but the momentum seems to be lost, says Becca, a human rights activist.
We're really excited that politics are on the tips of people's tongues this year, and it's an opportunity for us to leverage this moment and to insert something new into the dialogue or to radicalize it in some way. So, like, the mobilization is in a couple of different cities, you know, halfway across the country. What are we doing here in New York to warrant these giant monthly meetings and to keep people coming back?
Lizzie, a politically engaged musician, is planning a concert to protest the RNC in Minneapolis on September 1st. Strong organizations, she says, are community-based.
I think it's interesting that churches in this country and that faith-based movement is so organized. And I often look at that part of this country and think, why can't the left be more like that, where there's just incredible sense of passion on a weekly basis, people coming together and organizing and inspiring one another.
To be fair, there is something else in the election season which is motivating thousands to participate. JC, a member of a Yaya group, which promotes social justice and diversity, explains.
It's like the first time just someone, a woman, and someone of color actually got so close. And it's like, even if he doesn't make it, I think it was still going on in history. And for the fact that Hillary, too, how she got so close.
And for Malika, also from the Yaya Network, black youth only believes what it knows to be possible.
There's like a lack of black participation in stuff like this and a lack of motivation among the black youth. Right now, it's not too many things going on positive for black people. That's why I've been keeping close attention to this election.
And it has been years since so many communities have become energized. Beyond Obama mania, says Savitri, a member of the Church of Stop Shopping, we need to look at the positive angles.
We're attached in this country to the prodigal son and these sort of Jesus stories where just being the first son of an immigrant is already a huge story. And this election is about a personality, and it is. But being a child of immigrants makes you responsible to immigrants now in a way that someone whose parents came here 400 years ago would not necessarily be. If we actually thought that Obama was about to lose to McCain, would the people in this room work on his behalf?
Michael from the Yaya Network thinks Obama is empowering.
I feel like he raises discussions that people can talk about, whether it be, you know, black fathers or whatever. Just a range of things that he talk about. What he brings to the table is, I guess, open-mindedness. And I don't feel like he's having, like, a strict rhetoric. McCain, it's like Bush the Third or whatever.
But Aaron, an alternative economy activist, wants to stay lucid.
When it comes down to it, the choice between McCain and Obama is, do we want to continue a war in Iraq or do we want to continue war in Afghanistan? And they're both talking about future targets. So what kind of change is Obama really offering, and is it really that much of a difference?
At the end of the forum, there was a sense among all activists that evening that they understood what was at stake. For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. There will be no strike at Quest Communications. A tentative agreement was reached between the CWA, the IBEW, and Quest on Monday. The CWA said improvements were won in wages and in pensions. If ratified by the workers, the agreement will last for 3 years. Walmart is reportedly carefully reviewing a decision that gave 8 Canadian Walmart auto shop workers in Gatineau the first North American collective bargaining agreement at a Walmart. It's an arbitrator-imposed agreement that, according to the United Food and Commercial Workers, gave the union 98% of what it wanted. Workers will see their pay go up from $8.50 an hour to a minimum of $11.54. Walmart closed a store in Canada in 2005, just days before an arbitrator was to impose a labor contract then. It could close this store too, but the UFCW says it will be difficult because the collective bargaining agreement is already in hand. As unions gain a toehold at Walmart in Canada, both U.S. labor federations want the Federal Elections Commission to investigate possible illegal campaigning by Walmart in the states. Jesse Russell reports.
Two labor federations are challenging the Federal Elections Commission to investigate Walmart for alleged violations of election law. According to a recent story in the Wall Street Journal, Walmart has encouraged workers not to vote for presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama because he is a supporter of the Employee Free Choice Act. The complaint filed by the organizations to the FEC says there is a reason to believe that Walmart Stores Incorporated has made prohibited corporate expenditures by expressly advocating against Senator Obama's election to employees. The complaint was filed on behalf of the AFL-CIO, Change to Win, American Rights at Work, and WakeUpWalmart.com, four groups that have actively advocated for the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. Presidential candidate John McCain opposes the bill.
United Auto Workers President Ron Gettelfinger says that Senator Barack Obama is taking action to support American workers that will help automakers build cars of the future right here in the U.S. That includes a pledge of $4 billion in investments and low-interest credit for American auto companies. In stark contrast, Gettelfinger says, is Senator John McCain. The UAW president says that McCain seems content to rely upon the failed policies of George W. Bush, which have cost American workers millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs. The UAW believes the choice for president could not be more clear. Obama, the union says, is committed to changing failed policies, while McCain is offering nothing but more of the same failed economic policies. Unemployment for black men in America is high. In New York City's Red Hook district of Brooklyn, it's well over 20%. James Brodick is project director at the Red Hook Community Justice Center, where they're working to help neighborhood residents get job opportunities.
What we're trying to do is reach out to the business owners and saying, hey, is there different forms or different opportunities we can bring you in where you can meet some of our residents?
Workers Independent News, Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
From Countdown, from Keith Oberman.
Special guest, but first, the headlines breaking in the administration's 50 running scandals. Bush.
Number three, Fox is guarding the henhouse gate. Mr. Bush's U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has hired Hans von Spakovsky as a consultant and temporary full-time employee. Just let the temporary full-time employee oxymoron pass. Concentrate on the moron, moron. The nomination of Hans von Spakovsky to the Federal Election Commission was rejected because of his strident support for restrictions on voting rights. So the Civil Rights Commission reportedly wants him to oversee its report on how well the Justice Department is monitoring the 2008 presidential election. A plus. Great job. Well done. They did nothing at all. Number two, police state gate. More dribs and drabs coming out of the new Justice Department guidelines pertaining to the investigation of U.S. citizens in the U.S. Democrats briefed on the secret plan have now written to Attorney General Mukasey to remind him, hey, we're not living in the Soviet Union. They say the new guidelines would permit the FBI to open up an investigation of an American, conduct surveillance on him prior to his private records, not only without a warrant or a court order, but, quoting Russ Feingold's letter, without any basis for suspicion. And you're writing to Mukasey? Why? He's already established himself as Mr. Bush's legal mountebank, turning erosions of civil rights into good law. And number one, is Obama already running U.S. foreign policy gate? First, it was the hypothetical covert action in Pakistan he suggested, and the Bush administration actually ran several months later. Then it was the 12,000 additional troops to Afghanistan he called for, which the Bush administration proved yesterday. Now, after Obama launched his campaign for the presidency on the premise of timetables for withdrawal from Iraq, Secretary of State Rice reports from Baghdad that after meeting with the Iraqi foreign minister Hoshyar Zebari, the two countries have agreed to goals for American troop relocations, aspirational timetables, the regulation of temporary presence, the good old time horizons, and a timetable to withdraw American forces from Iraq by the 30th of next June. A timetable? Wait a minute. That sounds almost like a timetable.
In the wake of problems in the Florida 2000 election, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, in 2002.
Terrible piece of legislation that has encouraged states and counties all over the country to go to these god-awful, untested electronic voting machines.
HAVA required spending $3 billion of taxpayer money on new voting machines across the country. Touchscreen voting machines.
Why voting machines? Well, money.
The congressman who drafted HAVA was Representative Bob Ney of Ohio. Bob Ney's other successful legislation was to rename the Capitol Hill cafeteria's French fries as Freedom Fries, to shame France for not supporting the invasion of Iraq.
We have nothing against French people, the French language. However, we're angry at the French government. And today, you can have your toast, just make sure it's Freedom Toast.
Diebold paid Bob Ney's former chief of staff, David DiStefano, $180,000. And Jack Abramoff, $275,000, to convince Bob Ney to include their machines as part of HAVA. Jack Abramoff was later convicted of bribing Bob Ney. And now, in the 2006 race, Bob Ney pled guilty to corruption charges in the Abramoff scandal. He drops his bid for re-election and checks into rehab. One of Ney's aides reported that he would start drinking at 7:30 in the morning. That means the laws we now have that govern our national elections were written by a criminal while drunk. As in, have another drink.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Vermont's Department of Public Service recently released a draft of a comprehensive energy plan for the state. According to a law from the 1990s, energy is an important enough issue for the state to have an energy plan and to update it every 5 years. Good idea. Energy is the lifeblood of our economy, and an energy plan is as important for the state's future as an economic development plan, of which there are many. The current administration is 6 years overdue with its plan, but at least it's now out there for discussion. Unfortunately, this draft lacks most of the basics of a plan. It can be summarized by saying, "We're going to do a bunch of stuff." The plan catalogs 27 strategies with 68 specific recommendations. But it's not clear why we'd want to follow those strategies, or what we'd accomplish if we're successful in them. Let's take a look at a couple other approaches to energy planning. One is from the city of Portland, Oregon, whose peak oil task force completed their work last year. The other is a 2005 Energy Descent Action Plan, put together for the 7,000 residents of the town of Kinsale, Ireland, by permaculture students at a local college. What I'm looking for in an energy plan includes some assessment of where we are right now, how we got here, and what we can expect in the future. The Portland Peak Oil Task Force report is clear. The world's oil production is about to decline, and when it starts declining is relatively unimportant, because we're unprepared for the consequences. They recommend acting big and acting now to reduce oil and natural gas use by 50% within 25 years, just to stay ahead of the rate of depletion. The Portland report complemented the work of their earlier Local Action Plan on Global Warming. The city is also considering climate change. The Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan begins by describing our time as the beginning of the second half of the Age of Oil. Colin Campbell, a well-known petroleum geologist, projects an even more dire scenario than Portland's. It may be as few as 13 years before the oil and natural gas available to Kinsale has shrunk to about half its current levels. As Rob Hopkins, who taught the class that wrote the plan, says, "This has implications for every aspect of life in Kinsale." The Portland plan is all about staying ahead of changes that are bound to happen anyway. With oil more expensive and less available, for example, they foresee long-distance transport of food dropping off. For them, that translates into a need to boost local food production. In Kinsale, they map that transition on a timeline. For example, by 2010, they envision a market for local food so strong that hoop greenhouses appear on open land, and, quote, "the sound of chickens is once again heard in the town," unquote. By 2012, training is held in niche food production markets, like shiitake mushrooms and uncommon vegetables. None of these plans is perfect, and all of them will have to be changed as goals go unmet and conditions change in different ways than expected. What I like about the Portland and Kinsale plans is that they are explicit enough about their expectations that the people using them can tell whether they're being achieved or not, and whether goals need to be modified. With the Vermont plan, it's hard to tell where we are, or whether we're getting to where we're going, or what the obstacles are likely to be on the way. It's like planning a hike to a vaguely defined destination. You know, we're going over those mountains, without knowing much about the terrain, and consulting the weather forecast for yesterday. We can do better. I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Tomatoes. Oh, tomatoes. Do I even have to talk about the difference between rock-hard grocery store tomatoes from who knows where versus local heirloom tomatoes? There's so many varieties of heirloom tomatoes being uncovered that I can't really go into all of them in 180 seconds. So my advice to you, if you are new to heirloom tomatoes or just curious to learn more, is to find a farmer at the farmer's market who has lots of tomatoes being sold by variety and start asking questions. I'll just touch on a few of my favorites. My all-time favorite is the Black Prince. These can be hard to find, but they are worth the hunt. This tomato is recognizable by its incredibly dark, purpley-green hue. It's a dense and meaty tomato, really rich and sweet, without palate-scalding acidity. Second to the Black Prince is the Cherokee Purple, a mauve-y purple tomato with dark flesh. This is a giant, juicy, and sweet tomato, perfect for salads. Green zebras are small, green and yellow tomatoes, which stay green even when ripe. They have nice, firm flesh and a mellow, sweet, tart flavor. Green zebras make a great salad tomato because they hold their shape and they provide a nice contrast when paired with red tomatoes. If you're sensitive to the acidity in tomatoes, try some of the luminous white varieties, such as the Great White. These are really sweet and exotic tasting, and they have a very low acid content, as with many other white and yellow varieties. Striped tomatoes are a delight to behold. Hillbilly Stripe and Old German are two good examples. These tomatoes are usually huge, clocking in at well over a pound each, and are orange or yellow on top, melting into red at the bottom. When cut in half vertically, their striped flesh is stunning. How to serve these tomatoes? Start by tasting each tomato on its own. Add some crunchy salt, which will boost the sweetness. A little fresh mozzarella or some of those yummy cheese curds from Blue Jacket Creamery will provide a smooth balance for acidic tomatoes. And of course, a little fresh basil can almost make you cry for the love of summer. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS, LPFM, 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus Community Radio.